This is a Shadowcast Audiobooks feature presentation. Eyes and Knives by Pete Malicki. About the author. Pete Malicki is an Australian author who started writing at the age of 18. Achieving early success, he won a nationwide playwriting competition with his very first play, The New Inhabitant. He went on to complete 5 full-length novels, 20 plays, short stories, poetry, and song lyrics, and he has had articles published online, in magazines, and in newspapers such as the Sydney Morning Herald. In 2009, Pete founded his own independent publishing company, Helm Publishing, and printed this, his 4th novel, Eyes and Knives. And without further ado, I give you Eyes and Knives, Episode 3. Thursday, early morning. Ian Albright woke as he felt something jab into his side. Jenna Albright was lying beside him, fully dressed and smiling broadly. "Wake up, dear brother," she said. "I feel like going out for a little drive. Do you want to do some early morning meditation while it's still fresh out?"
"Sure," replied Ian as he rubbed his bleary eyes. "I'll get dressed."
"Great. I've already made you breakfast."
"You're a doll."
Jenna left the room as Ian crawled out from beneath the sheets. His late night last night had left him exhausted. After coming home from the hospital where he'd tussled with a strange woman, he'd been too wired to sleep, so he'd stayed up for a few hours, reading magazines. He had planned to sleep in, but that was clearly off the books now. Ian dressed, visited the bathroom, grabbed his mobile phone from the floor where he had thrown it earlier, and trudged down the corridor to the kitchen. Jenna was sitting at the dining table, eating pancakes while she flicked through a supermarket flyer.
"Peas are on special, dear," she said. "Since you don't do anything useful with your life, why don't you pick some up for me?"
"Sure," said Ian, as he sat and started his breakfast.
"Great. I can drop you at the shops after our meditation, if you like. I have a meeting this morning, so I can take you to Coles on my way. Sound okay?"
"Yeah, sure."
"Great. How are your pancakes? I used the same recipe Mom had back when she used to make us cookies."
Jenna chatted away as they ate their breakfast, Ian nodding and grunting as she did so. She was a lovely girl, she really was. But by God, she could go on sometimes. When they were both finished, they collected a few things and headed out to Jenna's car. It was much too early for traffic, so it didn't take them long to reach their destination, an isolated paddock. They parked nearby and crossed it by foot. At the far end of the paddock was a secluded valley. They headed silently through the thick bushland, and all the way down to the gentle stream, where they were completely out of sight. It was quiet, isolated, and peaceful.
"Shall we meditate here, dear brother?"
"Sure thing."
Ian unbuttoned his shirt and gently placed it on the ground. He undid his fly and looked up at Jenna, who was raising a scandalized eyebrow at him. With a grin, he reached over and pulled off her blouse. She tugged at his belt. A few minutes later, their clothes lay in 2 neat piles on the ground, shoes, underpants, and all. Naked, they walked alongside the stream for about a minute until Ian abruptly stopped.
"Here?" he asked. "This is more than enough."
"Well, I don't know. Sometimes your screaming gets pretty loud."
"I'd be more worried about the neighbors coming out with shotguns and Star Market System's bugs."
"Yeah, but if they hear you, they'll probably think someone's raping the horses."
"Ian!"
"I'm somewhat offended by that comment."
"You can't help your enthusiasm.
Oh, and Jenna?"
"Yes, love?"
"Take off those ridiculous nipples, would you? They freak me out."
Jenna had skin-colored tape over her real nipples, obscuring them. Towards the outside of her breasts, there were some very convincing rubber nipples, which captured the eye of many of her colleagues. She laughed and removed both the tape and the fake nipples, placing them reverently on the ground. Without another word, Jenna and Ian Albright started making love. 40 minutes later, Jenna reached back and placed a hand on Ian's chest.
"We have to finish, sweetheart. There's something I have to do before I go in today."
Ian paused.
"Really?" he protested. "But we don't get many opportunities to do this."
"Once a week is enough for me. Thanks, dear."
"Okay, then," Ian said with a sigh. He sped up his thrusting.
"Give me just give me another 10, oh,
10 what?"
laughed Jenna. Seconds? Minutes?
Shut up. I kept control for like an hour before you put the pressure on. Let's get dressed.
Oh, aren't you a romantic? Jenna drawled. But actually, no. I want to talk to you about something first. Have I ever told you about the initiation ritual at Star Market Systems?
The tall man shook his head.
No. Well, probably, but it doesn't ring a bell.
Jenna sighed. It's something they make you do when you become an inside member, a technology person. Every single person in the company who knows about Star Market's real identity must complete this ritual. And up until this point, I've managed to avoid doing it. Dane Hobson was negligent in his duties by not ordering me to do it, but he dropped its name in a meeting and I had to speak up. The CEO wants things rectified.
Background information established, said Ian.
Basically, they want me to kill somebody and bring their head into the office by midday. And it can't be the whole body, just the head. They want me to commit murder and butchery.
Ian nodded thoughtfully. You know, I do remember you telling me something like that before. Vaguely. I'm sure I remember you using the word butchery.
This isn't funny. I have to kill someone, and I have to do it now, this morning.
I can't do it for you?
Oh, Ian, you know that's not possible. There's probably a bug on every single item of clothing that either of us wear. It has to be done by me, and they'll know if it isn't.
Picking up a leaf and using it to cover his modesty, Ian took a few moments to think.
Tell me, are there any conditions to this initiation ritual?
Such as what?
Such as, does it matter who the person is?
Jenna shrugged. Dane didn't say.
Ian grinned. Well, then, I have an idea. Thursday morning.
Listen to this, said Dane Hobson, chief of security at Star Market Systems. His female companion leaned closer to the tape player.
What is it? She asked.
You know Jenna Albright?
Not personally.
She has been asked to perform the initiation ritual this morning, so when I arrived, I decided to play the recordings from some of the audio devices Miss Ellis planted on her clothing. I thought I might be able to find out whose head she's taken in advance.
The woman nodded and put her ear near the speaker.
Who's she talking to? She asked.
That's Ian Albright, her blood brother. She's made him some breakfast, and they're planning to do some meditation before she goes to a meeting, her euphemism of choice for performing the ritual. I've listened to countless numbers of their private conversations, and she's managed to keep him in the dark about the true nature of her job for years now.
Do they live together?
Yeah.
What does he do?
Dane smiled his humorless smile. He's an interesting character. Earns his keep by concocting intricate scams. The latest is dressing up as a City Rail transit officer and bribing people who don't have tickets.
Claire, the dark-skinned woman who worked in the security department, looked at her superior.
You're not one to take interest in trivial things, Mr. Hobson. What exactly am I looking for?
It's a bit further on. They drive out to a field somewhere and walk down to a river. This is where they meditate for about 15 minutes. Listen.
Dane fast-forwarded the recording to the relevant spot. Although he worked for a powerful technology company, he preferred to use cassette tapes rather than anything digital.
Tell me, what do you hear?
It sounds like they're walking, said Claire. Now they've stopped. She just asked if they should meditate here. He says sure. Now they're sitting down, moving positions. They're getting into a comfortable position to meditate in.
What's that? They're stripping, said Dane. What you hear is the bug being dropped on the ground. If you listen carefully right here, you can make out footsteps.
Claire narrowed her eyes in concentration, then nodded uncertainly.
I think I can. So you believe they've taken off their clothes and walked away somewhere?
Yes.
And why would they do that?
What do male and female generally do when they're alone and naked? Dane asked scornfully.
But they're siblings. Are you sure they're siblings?
Positive. We've run background checks on everybody here numerous times, including you, Claire Chantelworth, of 318 Victory Street, 34 years of age, single and looking. Father migrated to Australia from the Philippines in 19...
All right! I'd rather you keep my private details to yourself.
Claire scratched behind her ear and looked down at Dane.
So what are your thoughts about these two?
Is it incest?
I'm not sure.
The only reason they would take off their clothes and walk away from them is if they knew we had them bugged. Otherwise, they'd just fuck in their bedroom.
The main thing that concerns me is this might be some kind of pretense to allow them to talk without any of us listening in. Maybe they both work for the government, and she's a double agent.
Claire nodded slowly. So it's either incest or treachery. How will you find out?
I'll simply ask her. I doubt she'll be prepared for any hard questions after completing the task I assign her. It took me at least 3 kills before I was comfortable doing it, and another 2 before I started enjoying them.
The Dark Woman shuddered involuntarily. She'd performed the initiation ritual on a homeless person, and it ranked as one of the worst things she'd ever experienced. Murder should only be performed out of necessity, and she hoped to never reach a stage where she enjoyed it.
When's she due in, Mr. Hobson?
Actually, she's just arrived. Screen 4.
Claire looked at the security monitor and noticed Jenna Albright was standing in the main lobby, waiting for an elevator. There was a Hessian sack slung over her shoulder. Deduction told her that the bulge was a human head. It took a lot of gall to stand in public with something like that on your possession.
Is there anything else you want me to do for you, sir? Or shall I get on with my duties now?
Dane smiled to himself, knowing full well how uncomfortable his inferior was with the impending situation. You know, Miss Worth, I think you could be of use to me here. I'd like you to read this briefing paper I've been working on, and tell me what you think. It contains new ideas I'm hoping to integrate into Star Market System's security procedures.
Certainly, Mr. Hobson, said Claire. I'll take it to my desk.
Oh, no, I can't let you do that. It can't leave my sight until it's been cleared for distribution, and that's at least a month away. Consider it an honor that I'm even allowing you to know it exists.
Thank you, Claire replied weakly.
Dane handed her a folder and indicated one of the chairs near the bank of security screens.
Sit there, he said before turning away. For the next 2 minutes, poor Claire didn't take in a single word of what she was supposed to be reading. Instead, she watched Jenna on the screens in front of her. The busty senior manager was making her way towards Dane's office, Hessian sack bouncing lightly off her waist as she walked. Claire tried to focus in on Dane's report, but it was no use. Maybe this job wasn't for her. She didn't mind the violence, but severed heads was something else. Maybe she should go back to being a chef, working in the kitchens from dusk till dawn.
Good morning, Mr. Hobson, said Jenna as she let herself into the room. As you would have assumed, I am here to complete the initiation ritual. Is it a good time?
Giving Jenna his complete attention, Dane said,
Sure.
Jenna nodded her head at Claire.
Can we do this alone, please?
Is there a problem if she stays? She is security staff.
I'd rather she didn't.
I'd rather she did.
Look, Dane, is this part of what I'm supposed to do, or are you just going to make it hard for both of us? Surely the CEO wouldn't approve of you adding rules to the initiation ritual, especially after your negligence. You've already stirred him up enough.
Jenna's threat hit the mark. The CEO was the one person Dane was afraid of.
Claire, could you please leave us?
He asked sweetly.
There wasn't going to be an argument.
I'll be at my desk, Claire said, practically running out the door.
Good. Jenna, shut the door behind her, won't you? We don't want the wrong person surprising us. We wouldn't want to have to increase today's body count.
Jenna Albright closed the door and walked up to Dane's desk, dumping the sack in front of him. She stood behind the brawny young chief of security, resting her hands on his shoulders.
I thought I might give you a bit of a rub before you looked in the bag. I know you're a hard man, Dane, but I still think you'll get a bit of a shock when you see who I'd picked to be my victim.
Is that so? Dane said with a laugh. He was genuinely impressed that Jenna was able to make him feel even slightly uncomfortable. Not many people could do that.
Open it, she said as she squeezed his shoulders. See what's inside.
Okay then, Miss Albright, I will.
Dane smiled and untied the drawstring of the Hessian sack, pulling it open. Inside was a pumpkin with tomato sauce dabbled over it. Instinct told him something was wrong. Dane Hobson, chief of security at Star Market Systems, opened his mouth. It was the last thing he did before Jenna cut his head off with a hunting knife.
Thursday, early morning.
Gotcha,
said Saul as he pulled the Big Mac out of the bin. He brushed the cigarette butts off it and took a bite. Saul shuffled down the footpath toward the next bin. It was Justin's bin, but Justin would still be asleep at this time of day. Saul was going there at this early hour because there'd be hell to pay if he was caught outside his territory. People tend to assume that the homeless spend their days pushing shopping carts around, going through bins, and with a complete disregard to the concept of acceptable behavior, ranting unintelligibly at strangers. This assumption is partly incorrect, because most homeless people actually have territories, and there are unwritten rules about what can and can't be done within them. They don't much care about where their co-workers go during the day, or where they choose to sleep, but which bin you go through, or which corner you beg at, is strictly regimented. It is only fair that whoever is there first gets to choose the best spot and sit, and sell their product. That's right, sell their product. If you look at the homeless through cynical eyes, you'd see that they're actually providing an important service to society. They are in the business of guilt alleviation. Giving money to the homeless or to a charity collector on the street is an easy substitute for genuine social responsibility. Going through another bum's property was tantamount to theft, and Saul was hurrying to find anything of value in Justin's bin. There were a few newspapers, some chip packets, a chocolate bar wrapper, the remains of several hamburgers, and a bunch of other rubbish. Taking some fries and an almost empty Coke, he turned to hurry off but accidentally bumped into a passerby.
"Watch where you're going, you disgusting bum," she spat.
"You walked into me," said Saul. "Just 'cause I'm living on the streets doesn't mean you're above me."
"I'm not above you," the woman laughed. She pointed at the high-rise. "Look at that building over there. I live on the 50th floor."
"And the pigeons live on your roof," he retorted. "Does that make them above you?"
The woman put her hands on her meaty hips. "I'm impressed. I didn't know you people could speak English, let alone form a coherent sentence."
"Just shows how prejudiced you are. Should I stoop to your level, fatty?"
"Screw you. I may be on the large side, but at least I have enough self-respect to dress myself properly," Saul snorted.
"See those trousers you're wearing? The company they're made by is a fundraising front for a chemicals company. Every dollar you spent on them helped fund research into a new weapon or poisonous gas."
Whatever advantage Saul had gained, he just lost.
"Piss off, you mad fuck," said the woman as she shoved Saul and started walking off.
The homeless man fell to the ground, landed in an awkward heap. He grazed his arms on the concrete, a nasty wound that would get infected if he didn't clean it. But as it turned out, the woman had unwittingly saved his life. An ambulance came screaming around the corner, narrowly missing Justin's bin and the spot where Saul and the woman had just had their spat. The driver hit the brakes 20 meters up the road, put the sirens on, and jumped out of the vehicle. A male paramedic came striding towards them. Saul watched in fascination as the disheveled man approached his overweight counterpart and placed his hand firmly on her shoulder. She froze for a good 10 seconds, during which time the ambulance officer turned around and walked away, abandoning the ambulance with the siren still blaring. All of a sudden, the large woman snapped into action. She started hobbling along the footpath, then broke out into an awkward trot. "Oh my God," she screamed. "I'm gonna die! I'm gonna die!"
In Saul's opinion, this was a rather over-the-top reaction to a bit of early morning exercise. What he didn't know was that the woman was going to explode if she slowed down below 5 kilometers per hour. She would shower the streets with her insides if her walking speed dropped below that of a fast march. 8 minutes later, this happened. She couldn't keep up the pace. But Saul didn't witness the spectacle. He was too busy hiding from the enraged Justin, who had just come around the corner and was yelling out his name.
Thursday, late morning. It had been a miserable night for Rory Henderson. He hadn't been able to sleep because of the pain in his leg, and the blanket provided by the police department was thin and ineffective against the cold. Boredom and discomfort had been his only companions as the hours stretched by. He tried to make sense of what had happened to him yesterday, but couldn't work it out. How could he be up for murder charges? It was ridiculous. Killing someone was the kind of thing you generally remembered doing. He should use his phone call. Wasn't he entitled to a phone call after being arrested? But who would he call? His mom? She would only scoff. His girlfriend? He'd only get her worried. Surely he'd be let out soon anyway, when they realized he was innocent. There had been virtually no activity in the police station until about 7 a.m., when the morning shift started. It was another few hours before anyone paid him the slightest bit of attention. Just when he thought he would die of boredom, Rory heard footsteps and a metallic clang. He looked over at the door to his cell, then dragged himself into a sitting position as Constable Allison Jacobs entered.
"I'm sorry," he said. "I didn't realize I was having guests. I would have put on my good suit."
Much to his bewilderment, the police officer said nothing as she came and sat next to him on the bed. She took her hat off and stared into it, then jumped as Rory asked her, "Are you okay?"
I don't know," she said. "I saw something last night that..." "Can you tell me more about what happened to you yesterday?"
The 24-year-old furrowed his brow at the policewoman's strange behavior.
"Well, Officer Jacobs, is it?"
"Please, Allison."
"Okay, then. Allison, I had a big night out in the town the night before last. I got a little drunk. I stayed over with my girlfriend."
Rory paused to observe Allison's reaction to the revelation that he wasn't single. He wondered if she had come into his cell because she thought he was cute and wanted to chat him up. He was fit and good-looking, and after what happened to him yesterday, he was expecting anything.
But she didn't seem interested, so he continued. I woke up early because I had to go home and get changed into some clothes that weren't covered in beer. When I arrived there, well, my house had burned down. Mom left the oven on before going out. It's not the first time she's done that, but it is the first time we lost a house because of it.
They're blaming you for that?
Rory scowled. Sorry, they. Do you mean the police?
Yes, I suppose since we think you murdered someone and went on a crime spree, we're going to blame you for everything else that happened yesterday.
The proverbial light bulb flickered on.
You think I'm innocent, don't you?
Yes. Well, no. Well, it's hard to answer a question like that. You said you passed out, right? And you had no memory of what happened until you were detained?
Pretty much. I left the office after my asshole boss told me to take a day of unpaid leave. And like 5 seconds after I left the building, I just collapsed. The last thing I remember was this angry-looking guy coming at me. I ignored him. Then the next thing I know, it was evening and I was being arrested.
Allison nodded. Then words burst out of her like a busted water main.
When we caught you yesterday, one of my colleagues, Brad, drove away for no reason that anyone could work out. Later, we were informed that he'd driven the squad car into the front of someone's house. A neighbor rang 911 right away, so Constable Blackman and I went to the scene. The woman from the house, she died while we were there. A man had shot her in the stomach. The same man had told neighbors he'd hurt them if they didn't leave him alone. So fortunately, they all got out of his way. It looks a lot like the man was Brad. He'd been locked up in the music room, presumably by the owners. But he claims to have no memory of the event, so we can't be sure. We have him in custody right now. The funny thing is, Brad was acting really strange when I let him out of that room. It was as if he didn't know who we were, or who he was. Constable Blackman had to shoot him in the arm because he was going for my gun. Then all of a sudden he had no idea of what was happening. Much like when we got you. Then one of the paramedics got up and ran away, taking the ambulance and leaving his partner at the scene. It was as if something was possessing Brad. Then it let go of him and took over the ambulance guy instead. Just like how it left you and took Brad.
Rory frowned as he assimilated this information, then nodded vigorously to himself.
I think I missed one of the details there, Allison, but I got the main point. You believe me, don't you? You think I was possessed, and whatever did that to me has also possessed Brad and the ambulance driver.
Allison nodded.
So I can go free then?
Allison shook her head.
No, even if I'm not crazy, and you really were possessed, you still committed those crimes. Someone has to be held responsible, and that someone is you. Maybe you could plead temporary insanity.
But it wasn't me! Somebody or something had control of my body!
I'm afraid there isn't a law for something like this. Your mind may not have committed those crimes, but your body sure did. And that's all that matters.
But... An angry voice from outside the cell cut Rory off. Allison! Get your ass out here this instant! Allison smiled weakly at Rory and stood up, walking out of the room without another word. He sighed and lay back down on his bed, resigned to a day of idleness and boredom. He had no idea of how close he was to getting out of there. Thursday, midday. In many respects, the government office was very different from the one of Star Market Systems. One was a skyscraper, the other was partially underground. One had a busy call center, the other had an indoor gym. One was filled with thieves, liars, and murderers, the other spies and secret agents. The decor was quite different, too. But they had a lot more in common than anyone would care to admit. Their true identities were so elaborately disguised that there was no documented evidence of their existence. The deepest probing would uncover nothing more sinister than a telemarketing company and a recruitment agency called Next Step. People who worked for these two organizations were either oblivious to what they really did or deeply involved in their secrets. Two of those involved in the secrets of the government were Bob and William. Both of them had started their covert work rather inadvertently. Having come to Next Step in order to escape the drudgery of their old jobs, they were put through rigorous psychological testing, ostensibly to determine what their business skills were, but in reality to see if they would suit the role of secret agent. They had both passed with flying colors. Currently, Bob and Williams sat with their hands folded in their laps as they waited for the boss to arrive. A complete contrast to these muscular men, John was short, balding, untidy, and highly strung. He was prone to fits of swearing and cursing, and was known to smash the odd piece of crockery against the wall. He was a big believer in the theory that breaking something is a good way of getting attention. The door burst open, and John hurried into the room, seating himself at his desk. "Men, report, please!" The two big men exchanged glances, Bob nodding slightly to indicate that he would speak. "Today is shaping up to be a big day," he started. "Two significant events have already taken place." "Fire away," said Bob as he sipped some coffee. "Give me the big one first." Bob and William exchanged another glance. "It's difficult to say which one is the big one, sir. Are you familiar with Star Market System's initiation ritual?" "The beheading thing, of course. They finally asked our Jenna to do it. She chose Chief of Security Dane Hobson as her victim." John spat coffee. "Holy fuck! Holy fuck, that is some news and a fucking half! Jenna killed him?" "With a hunting knife," Bob affirmed. "With a hunting knife? Well, I'll be damned and burn in hell. That woman never ceases to amaze me. Tell me, before I get carried away, what event is equally significant to that?" "Sir, we have gained further insights into what happened to Paul Hirsch and the woman with the pram, Marnie. Less than an hour ago, one of my team members overheard news of an interesting event that took place last night. A local constable, Brad Grass, drove a squad car into someone's house, then shot the owners moments before he managed to lock himself in a music room." "Maybe she put Oasis on," laughed John. He quickly sobered up as the pair exchanged a look. "Sorry, continue." Bob did so. "Grass is currently being held in custody at his own station, along with a Rory Henderson, who is being held for murder and arson. Both of them are claiming to have no recollection of what they did, just like Marnie. My man was listening to a conversation between Henderson and an officer, Allison Jacobs. She is convinced that something is possessing these people, taking control of them one by one. It went from Henderson to Grass, then to an ambulance driver who allegedly fled the scene where Grass shot his victim. Early this morning, the ambulance driver was spotted acting strangely by another of my men. Shortly thereafter, a woman exploded in the center of the city. The second such incident in 2 days." John frowned as he processed this information. "What are you getting at? It sounds like a bunch of loose points. What's your conclusion? Do you think Star Market Systems is somehow responsible for taking control of these people's bodies?" Bob nodded. "From the evidence we have accumulated, I'd say it's quite likely. Such technology would not be out of their league." "Then what are they doing with such a public display of this technology? Are they trialing it? Why would they want the whole world to see what they're doing?" William spoke up at this point. He hadn't yet contributed to the conversation. "It's difficult to say. I personally believe that Star Market are responsible for these possessings. They are doing them to test out a new technology, which might also explain Hirsch's suicide. He was the first test subject, probably because he was a security threat to the technology side of the business. Marty was the next subject, simply because she was in the wrong place at the wrong time. Since her, it has gone from person to person. Perhaps they've lost control of whatever it is that takes over these people. Impossible to say how it works. Its technology is way out of our league. If our assumptions are correct, there might be trouble brewing."
"You're damn fucking right there's trouble brewing," said John. "And what about the explosions? Suicide bombings in Sydney?"
"We can't work them out," Bob said. "They seem to take place in close proximity to the possessed individuals. Otherwise, there's no link." John chewed on his lip, mulling everything over.
"If there's no restriction on who Star Market can possess, then we have no way of telling who's under their control and who isn't. We'll have even fewer people to trust."
Quick as a flash, the short man produced a gun from nowhere and had it trained on Bob's forehead.
"Maybe we can't trust Bob anymore." He turned the gun on himself. "Or maybe we can't trust me."
There was a long moment of awkward silence. As abruptly as he'd taken out his weapon, John had concealed it again. He grinned.
"Just fucking with you guys. Bob, you want to fetch me Marnie, please? I know Ian chatted to her last night, but I think we need her in our custody. William, fetch me this Henderson from the police station. And could someone get Ian to come have a word with me? Thanks, man. Good day."
Bob and William exchanged a final glance, got to their feet, and left the room. John watched them leave before sculling the rest of his coffee and leaned back in his chair.
"God damn," he told himself. I feel one of those days coming on. Minutes later, Ian Albright knocked on his door.
Purchase an author-signed copy of Eyes and Knives with a 50% discount on postage. Email helmpublishing@gmail.com with Shadowcast in the subject heading. You will receive an invoice through PayPal, and your signed copy will be posted to you upon receipt of payment. The music featured in this episode was The Cove by The Contrarian. Thanks for listening.